again. 39.3. Then 39.1. She'd considered calling for an ambulance, her hand hovering over her phone. But then Brody's cries had subsided into restless murmurs. She'd watched the clock, counting the slow creep of the small hours, her gaze flicking between the glowing digits and the thermometer screen. Bit by bit, as the night bled into morning, the numbers edged lower. When it finally dipped below 38 and Brody settled calmer at last, tears of relief pricked at her eyes. This morning, she can't shake the memory of Pete's flushed, sneering face. It sends a ripple of anger through her exhausted state as she realizes what she's done. The trouble is, it won't be nearly as easy to get rid of him as it was to take him back. It was Alicia who had coaxed her, bruised and bleeding, to the police station last time, the voice of reason and strength when everything else in Jen's life was crumbling. Without Alicia, Jen knows she'd never have had the courage to walk into that sterile room and tell a stranger what Pete had done. Alicia was always the stronger of the two of them, even though she was younger. She had a resolve and a determination that Jen lacked, and an insight into others. Jen can still remember the day they found a lost dog in the park. 15-year-old Jen was already backing away nervously when Alicia crouched down, her hand outstretched. "You'll get bitten," Jen whispered, her heart pounding. But Alicia just clicked her tongue softly, inching closer. "He's scared, that's all." Minutes passed, and Jen couldn't breathe, convinced any second the dog would lunge. But Alicia's patience won out. Soon enough, the mutt was nosing at her fingers, his tail giving a tentative wag. "You can tell the good ones from the bad ones," she said afterward, when the owner came looking for her lost dog and thanked them for keeping him safe. "Just like with people, you have to listen to your gut." And now, Jen had failed to listen to her gut and had taken Pete back again, though she swore she never would. Like a fool, she'd swallowed all his lies, all the pleas for another chance, the promises that he was a changed man. Most worrying, he clearly hasn't stopped drinking like he claimed. But there are a multitude of other small things that tell her all is not well. The way his eyes flash at small irritations, the veiled remarks about her nagging or making him look bad. Then there was the way he'd grabbed her wrist hard enough to leave bruises. She notices how his phone buzzes more than it should, how he locks it whenever she's near. This morning, he left early, leaving behind the sour taste of her suspicion. Is he stealing again? Sleeping with someone else? She scrubs at a mark on the kitchen counter with a cloth, her jeans bag on her once curvy hips, the belt pulled to its last notch around her waist. Hunger gripes in her stomach, but she ignores it. Eating feels like too much effort when her insides are so tightly coiled. When was the last time she slept? Properly slept. She feels like a dead man walking. She rinses her cup at the sink, and a sudden movement outside jolts her. She whips her head toward the window and sees a figure by the back gate. A tall, broad man dressed in dark clothing, his face partly obscured by the hood pulled low over his head. Jen's first instinct is to check the lock. She rushes over to the back door, fingers fumbling as she confirms it's secure. The man glances up, catching her movement through the glass, and she freezes. He steps closer. Her thoughts race. Could Pete have brought trouble to their doorstep? He's done it before. Dodgy dealings, unpaid debts. Jen closes the kitchen door to avoid disturbing Brody's rest. Then she returns to the window. His knock echoes through the house, loud, persistent. She flattens herself against the wall, her heartbeat pounding in her throat. She doesn't dare move. The knock comes again, harder still this time, the glass rattling in its frame. The hooded shadow fills the doorway, blocking out the light. Jen's breathing is shallow. She forces herself across the room, her legs wooden, and slips the chain across the door before cracking it open an inch. "Who are you? What do you want?" Her voice sounds weak despite her best efforts to steady it. The man shifts slightly, the angle of his body keeping his face partly covered. Her heart sinks as he jams the toe of his boot into the gap before he begins to speak in a rough, low voice.
I'm looking for someone. Alicia Turner.
You must have the wrong house. The man makes a noise of amusement as Jen says again, What do you want? His next words turn her blood to ice. Chapter 18. Alicia. While Trent's still out, I send him a text. Cooking tonight? Thought we could have a quiet one, just us? His reply comes almost instantly.
Sounds perfect. Be back around 8.
Good. That's what I need. Time alone with him. No distractions. A chance to get closer, to steer the conversation where I want it to go. I keep dinner simple. Steak, roast potatoes, nothing too elaborate. But intimate. When he walks in, pulling off his tie and rolling up his sleeves, he looks as unruffled as always, like nothing ever truly unsettles him. I watch him for a moment, taking in the way he moves, the quiet confidence in every gesture. He seems completely at ease, like a man who always knows exactly where he stands. But I don't know, and I can't let the question simmer any longer. We settle on the sofa after dinner. My glass of wine cool against my palm. I swirl the pale liquid, keeping my tone light. Hazel mentioned something earlier about your last partner. Said she was a good organizer. I glance at him, gauging his reaction. Because what I really want to do is cut to the chase and ask why she's not around anymore.
Hazel likes to talk too much,
he says, his expression giving nothing away. But there was someone else here who used to help with your events and other things. I keep my tone neutral. Someone who worked for you, like me. I wonder if he'll brush it off, try to reassure me. He sighs, moving along the sofa so that he sinks down beside me.
It's nothing to worry about, Alicia. I wasn't with her for long. We had different priorities in the end.
So you employed her on the same understanding as me? I can't help the note of insecurity in my voice, and Trent catches it. To be your eyes and ears on the ground?
It wasn't the same, no. Saskia wasn't the right fit, and she certainly wasn't you.
His words land softly, and there's a quiet intensity in the way he looks at me. I hold his gaze, letting the silence stretch just long enough to make it feel like I'm considering what he's just said, like it means something. I take a slow sip of wine, setting my glass down carefully. What happened to her? Trent's expression doesn't change at first. Then there's the slightest flicker of something behind his eyes that wasn't there before.
What?
I keep my tone light, curious. Like this is just idle conversation and not something that's clawing at the edges of my mind. It's just, Hazel told me she died. His jaw tightens, and then he nods, slow and deliberate.
It's the worst thing that's ever happened to me,
he says quietly.
In some ways, I'll never get over it, seeing her like that.
A chill runs through me. But I can't afford to back off now. You were there when she died. This time, there's no flicker, no hesitation, just a heavy, impenetrable silence that follows my question. I ride it out. Finally, his eyes darken, his voice thick and choked.
I was the one who found her.
I let out a quiet breath, shifting closer, my hand resting lightly on his arm, a careful touch. Just enough pressure to say, I'm here for you, I understand. Oh, Trent, I'm so sorry. That must have been beyond awful for you. This is the best chance I've got to prize something out of Trent I can pass on to Betts. I've got to feed the monster with something if I've any chance of keeping him at bay. He swallows hard,
looking down at his glass like the answer might be in the deep red swirl of his Amarone.
"It was," he murmurs. "You know, I still see her sometimes. Her hair, her eyes, the way she..."
He stops himself, shaking his head.
"Sorry."
"You don't have to apologize, Trent." I squeeze his arm, my voice low, coaxing. "I can't imagine what that must have been like, walking in and seeing..." I let my words trail off deliberately, giving him space to fill in the blanks. His grip tightens around the stem of his glass, and he exhales sharply, blinking hard.
"I tried everything to save her, but she was already gone.
I have to get this out. It's now or never." "Is it true she died in the swimming pool where you took me on..."
"What?"
He looks up sharply, confusion on his face.
"Why on earth would you think that?"
I saw it online, an article."
This is going from bad to worse. He'll know I've been snooping now.
"Obviously, I was shocked when I heard about Saskia. I googled it and an article came up."
Trent scowls and shakes his head. "That must be fake news. It's certainly not true."
I nod slowly, like I'm processing his grief, but really, my mind is turning over every detail of his lie. She was alone. No one else pulled her out. No immediate help. It was the only article I'd found, so maybe he's right. It's just... it was from the London Metro, so... I let a flicker of hurt cross my face. "But why didn't you tell me?"
"I was going to, but I didn't want you to see it that way. Through press lies,"
he says, rubbing a hand over his face.
"I know how it must look, but I'm being honest here."
"Okay, I believe you," I say. "I'm sorry to drag it all up, but I'd rather ask you directly than listen to gossip."
"Alicia, I swear, she wasn't in the pool."
He looks annoyed and uncomfortable.
"I can't believe you think I'd take you up there if..."
His gaze snaps to mine, guilt flashing there. Good. He needs to believe I care about his gigantic omission about the pool, not just what it means. My fingernails graze his hand. "I get that, I do." I hesitate, then push just a little further. "But, Trent, did they ever find out what really happened to her?" There it is. The question that matters. The one I need an answer to. His shoulders tense, and for a second, I think he won't respond. But then he exhales, staring at some invisible point in the distance.
"They said it was an accident."
His voice is flat, resigned.
"No sign of struggle. No reason to think otherwise."
He finally looks at me again, his expression raw.
"It never made sense to me."
I keep my face neutral. Let the silence settle between us like I'm just absorbing his pain. Trent stands up.
"Sorry, I can't do this. I'm going to take a shower."
I follow him to the bathroom and lean in the doorway as he peels off his shirt. It's hard not to drink in the lean lines of his body even though this is all business.
"You did the right thing in speaking to me. I should have explained. It's just... I hate going back there, you know?"
He looks shot, floored by the memory of it, and yet he refuses to meet my eye. "I can understand that, but it would help me understand if we can talk about it." "Of course I don't understand, not really. All I can think is that if Saskia didn't die in the pool, then where did she die? I need details to see if this line of inquiry is going anywhere." Trent turns on the shower and then leans toward me. His hand sliding over mine, warm and steady. He pulls me in close, his gaze settling on me with that familiar intensity, and I feel the weight of his words.
"I don't want to talk about the past. You're who I want, Alicia.
he says, his voice low and sure.
Fancy taking a shower together?
Steam begins to quickly fill the room, and he slips off the rest of his clothes. Trent doesn't wait for an answer. He steps into the spray, the warm water rushing over his body. Droplets race down his hard, lean torso and the deep cut of his hips. He runs a hand through his wet hair, pushing it back, his movements slow, unhurried. Heat simmers low in my abdomen. He's exactly the kind of man who could make it dangerously easy to forget myself. But that's not going to happen. He grins, enjoying the fact I'm watching him. He holds out a hand.
Join me.
I shake my head and move away. I can't let myself fall for the illusion. Not unless I want to kiss goodbye to my chance of freedom and a life with my son. Chapter 19. Trent. Trent feels a weight settling on his chest when he pads back into the lounge in his robe. She's off with him. Different. And it's not just fatigue or a bad mood. It's something that's appeared after their conversation about Saskia's death. Is she on to him? Alicia's expression is unreadable as she moves to the kitchen to clear up after their meal, and he could swear her voice lacks its usual warmth. This won't take long. We could watch something later if you like. Maybe a movie?
Sounds good, he answers vaguely.
He'd usually tell her to leave the kitchen for Ingrid in the morning, but it serves his purpose to let her get on with it. The second she's out of sight and loading the dishwasher, he moves swiftly down the hall. In his office, he locks the heavy reinforced door behind him, pressing his palm flat against the cool steel that means he can rest assured the stuff he keeps in here is safe. He stands there a moment, hand lingering on the handle, before moving to his desk. His pulse kicks up, breath just a little too quick. He stands there a moment, fingers tight on the handle, listening. Nothing. Just the distant sounds of the kitchen. He exhales sharply, but it does nothing to ease the knot in his chest. He strides to his desk, the imposing Victorian walnut beast that has held more secrets than most people could stomach. His laptop sits closed on the surface, an unassuming presence, but Trent knows better. Everything, everything is in there. He presses the power button, tapping his fingers against the wood as the screen flickers to life. Maybe he's being paranoid. Maybe Alicia's just curious. But something in the way she asked about Saskia, the way she looked at him when she said, "Trent, why didn't you tell me?" It bothers him. He's learned the hard way that lingering thoughts can lead to problems. His fingers fly across the keyboard, pulling up security logs, transaction records, things she can't see, things no one should see. Trent reaches for a small key in the desk tidy and inserts it into the lock in the desk drawer and turns it, the mechanism grinding faintly before clicking open. Slowly, he slides the drawer open and retrieves the folder inside. He places it on the desk and considers its contents. His fingers hover before he lifts out a photograph, its edges slightly worn from frequent handling. It shows Trent, laughing against a glittering evening backdrop of the Eiffel Tower. Next to him is a woman, blonde, willowy, her smile radiant but guarded. Her image always hits him like a punch to the gut. The sharp line of her jaw, the cool detachment in her eyes, despite the warmth of her expression. Trent grimaces and pulls out a passport. The cover is scuffed, the gold lettering slightly faded. He flips it open to see the photograph inside. Saskia's features are severe against the pale background, her mouth unsmiling, but her eyes hold that same flicker of challenge that used to turn him on. He reads the name aloud, the words coming out as a near whisper.
Saskia Portman.
Underneath all the paperwork is the memory stick. He knows it's not the only copy, but so long as he keeps to his end of the bargain, the original will never see the light of day. As extra insurance, he employed a specialist IT company to clean up his name under the General Data Protection Regulation. All traces of and connections between Trent Connors, the Orbit, and Saskia Portman removed from the internet, thanks to GDPR. He thought he had left no rock unturned. Trent carefully replaces the passport in the folder before locking it away again. It's out of sight, but the weight of it lingers in his chest. He exhales sharply and sits back, fingers steepled under his chin. Alicia is clever, certainly. Observant, too. She seems to be in awe of him. Or is he missing something? Attractive as she is, what does he really know about her? Trent shakes his head to dispel the unhelpful thoughts. If Alicia has her secrets, then let her keep them for now. How bad can it be? Their arrangement has clear boundaries, at least in his mind. And she was brilliant in the Manchester meeting. It felt like she really believed in him and in the project. He drums his fingers on the desk, staring into the middle distance. The issue isn't Alicia, not really. It's him. He's been careless in the past, and it serves as a reminder of something he's tried very hard to leave behind. A flicker of unease shakes through him. Alicia has surprised him before with the occasional glimpse of steel behind her otherwise gentle demeanor. It's easy to dismiss her as naive. But what if that's exactly what she wants him to think? Maybe he should get his PI guy onto it, just to make sure. He takes a final glance around the office. Everything in here is undisturbed and as he left it, but his chest still tightens. If Alicia is actively digging, if she is onto something, she could find enough in here to hang him. Chapter 20. Saturday. Alicia. The morning of the summer party arrives in a rush of deliveries and last-minute decisions, but here in the penthouse, I have a moment of quiet. For now. The chaos beyond this door is someone else's problem, at least for the next few minutes. Trent has everything scheduled to the second. My event hair and makeup will be done by professionals this afternoon, but this part, the ritual of getting ready for the day ahead, I want to take my time over. I shower and dress in jeans and a clean white t-shirt. I cleanse my skin ready for later and brush my hair back into a smooth ponytail. Tonight is my big chance. If I play this well, I can keep both my bosses happy, find something useful on one to give to the other. I step back, assessing my neat reflection. I look cool and composed, exactly how I need to be. My phone lights up silently on the counter. I thought I'd left the sound on. I pick it up and the screen shows several missed calls and text messages. My heart gives a little jump when I see they're all from Jen. Walking into the bedroom, I open the latest text, and dread spills through me as I read her words. Brody taken a turn for the worse. Temp is sky high, and he has a rash. I'm taking him to A&E. Shit, shit, shit. Panic floods through me. My child. I tried to calculate how long it would take to get to Nottingham and back. 2, maybe 3 hours each way with train and cab travel. There's no way I could possibly do it and return in time. The party is tonight, and if I just disappear... I sit down heavily on the edge of the bed, staring blankly at the spotless cream carpet. All my excitement for tonight drains away in an instant, but I force myself to stay focused. The party isn't just a party, it's an opportunity. A chance to get what I need to prove I can handle this. I can't afford to let anything get in the way of that, not tonight. Trent has no interest in Brody. He's asked me nothing about him, never inquires how he is. I know what his reaction will be if I tell him I have to leave. But now, all I can think about is Brody. The thought of my son lying in a hospital bed, scared and feverish. He needs me. I should be there with him. As I'm sitting there, head in my hands, debating what to do, another text pings through. We're at A&E, waiting. I'll let you know as soon as he's been seen. I know from what Jen says, she doesn't expect me to drop everything and shoot over there. In her own way, she's trying to reassure me, but it only makes me feel worse. I feel like it's getting harder to live this double life and keep everyone happy. Tears prickle in my eyes, and I blink them back. I stand up, walking to the bathroom and shutting the door behind me. I lean over the sink, gripping the edges, trying to steady myself, but the tears come anyway, hot and fast. I press a hand over my mouth, trying to stifle the sound, but my shoulders shake of their own accord. The weight of it all, the guilt, crashing down on me. I'm caught fast, trapped between two lives, including the part no one knows about, not even Jen. I don't know how long I stay there, quietly sobbing into the silence, but eventually I hear someone call my name. Quickly, I wipe my eyes, splash water on my face, and take a few steadying breaths. I can't let anyone see me like this. It's imperative to hold it together. When I walk to the top of the stairs, one of the florists is waiting in the lounge, looking slightly awkward. "Sorry to disturb you, miss, but we just need to know where you'd like the floral arrangements." "Oh," I manage, clearing my throat and forcing a smile. "Yes, thank you, just let's put them in the entrance, right where the guests will see them when they arrive." The florist nods, satisfied, and leaves. My mind races with images of Brody, his little face hot with fever, the pale, drawn look of him whenever he's ill. I'd give anything to be with him right now. Yet I'm doing this for my son. To start again somewhere I don't have to hide or live in fear. I take a few deep breaths, forcing myself to calm my thoughts. I must trust Jen, I tell myself. I must trust that she'll let me know if things get worse, that she'll call me if I need to be there. And until then, I'll hold my ground and keep it together. Another staff member appears, clipboard in hand, ready to discuss the next detail, the next arrangement. I straighten up, putting on a mask of calm that I barely feel, and walk down the spiral staircase with a smile. "Don't forget," Trent reminds me in the lift, "the one in my sights tonight is Steve Betts." I swallow and nod, push Brody's beautiful face out of my mind. "He usually arrives late, if at all," Trent goes on, "but he's assured me he'll be calling in. He's a major block in me getting the Manchester contract, my biggest investment for next year, so it'll be a great chance for you to meet him, size him up. I need to make sure he really is out of trouble these days, as he claims to be. Otherwise, and I hope this is the case, I can use his troubles to finish him." "Troubles?" Trent nods as he tweaks his bow tie in the lift mirror. "A couple of years ago, Betts had a lot of personal problems. His wife filed for divorce and took him to the cleaners. The courts gave her a massive settlement and a large chunk of his assets, including the family home. But when she stopped him from seeing the kids, he went downhill fast." It's not what I want to hear, but I play the game. "Sounds tough. Why did she divorce him?" "I've heard a few sketchy rumors that someone framed him, but nobody knows for sure. The most probable scenario is he'd been a naughty boy. He had a reputation as a womanizer, so I'm guessing it was something to do with that." Naughty boy doesn't even half cut it. "Betts went to a dark place, got in with some dodgy people. He was in a deep hole for sure." "Shocking," I say, though what I'm really thinking is, does Trent even know half of what this man is capable of? "But in true Betsy form, he seems to have clawed his way back, and now he's installed in a fancy country pile and claims his conglomerate is bigger and better than ever." "Gotta hand it to the guy," Trent remarks. "He checks out perfectly on paper now, but he keeps his investors and collaborators very close to his chest. I could really use some leads in that area."
"You think he's still involved with some of those dodgy people?"
Trent nods. "I think it'd be worthwhile you giving him some special attention tonight, if you know what I mean. Gain his trust and get some clues about where his weak spot might be." I swallow hard.
"I'll do my best."
The moment we step into the party playground, it feels as if the entire crowd of guests turns toward us. I smile freely, but I don't stop to chat, not yet. The night is young, and I want to take stock of who's here before I decide where to spend my time.
The soft strains of the string quartet ripple through the air, mingling with the hum of low, elegant conversation. The space glows, bathed in golden light from the chandeliers, their reflections shimmering off every glass and polished surface. Tables are laden with delicate arrangements of white roses and soft pink peonies I personally approved, their scent just strong enough to notice as we walk by. The guests themselves look fabulous. Men in crisp black tie, their patent shoes gleaming. Women in flowing evening gowns that glint with sequins and jewels under the light. Every detail is immaculate. Every person looks so polished and perfect. And yet, they are all looking at us. I glide forward, aware of every pair of eyes taking in my stunning emerald silk gown, the fabric hugging my body like it was made for me. Because it was. The gown skims my shoulders and flows into a soft, rippling train. The heavy necklace around my neck is a constellation of emeralds and diamonds, a perfect match for the earrings that I know catch the light with every turn of my head. I feel their brilliance, their weight, a visible sign of this new, untouchable version of me. I need to be here. There's no question about that. But this is the last place I want to be when what I really long to do is kiss my son goodnight. I pray everything is okay at the hospital. I already checked my phone half a dozen times before we left the penthouse. Beside me, Trent walks with an easy confidence, his tuxedo as sharp as his jawline. His hand brushes the small of my back, a subtle reassurance, or maybe a signal, as if to say, "You're doing great." Once we're fully in the room, the guests surge forward, smiles wide and eager, not just to greet him, though they do, with warm handshakes and murmurs of, "Trent, good to see you." No, it's me too. Their gazes flicker toward me, with curiosity and admiration, their hands extending toward mine as though I'm someone they've always wanted to meet. I shake hands, exchanging nods and polite smiles, all while my pulse races beneath the glamour. I have to make tonight count. "That last photographic collection of yours was stunning," I tell a silver-haired woman in a sleek black gown. "The way you played with light and shadow, it completely changed the mood of the space." I don't add that I've never seen her work in person, only studied it online last night, making notes, preparing for this exact conversation. She gives me an approving smile. "How wonderful to hear. Most people only focus on the price tag." I move on smoothly, turning to a man with a whiskey in hand. "Congratulations on the expansion. I hear the Dubai deal was a nightmare to close." He exhales sharply, shaking his head. "Understatement. You wouldn't believe the hoops they made us jump through." I laugh lightly, as if I've heard the details firsthand, as if I belong here. The conversation flows, each one more effortless than the last. Art, business, philanthropy. I have something ready for all of them. I adjust my posture, keep my expression warm but unreadable, let them see only what I want them to. I am pulling this off. I'm actually pulling this off. I look up, getting a distinct feeling I'm being watched. Beady eyes are trained on me from the far corner of the room. And I realize it's Janice, my old boss, looking true to form as though she's chewing a wasp. I wiggle my fingers in a friendly gesture, but she looks quickly away and doesn't return my smile. She's clearly still twisted up inside about my rise from fired waitress to Trent Connor's girlfriend. Does she realize I could ask to have an alternative manager work at future Orbit events? It would be so easy to get Hazel to contact Elevate, to set the wheels in motion. But although Janice is spiteful and bitter, it doesn't mean I have to follow suit. Besides, there are bigger fish I need to fry. In the lift earlier, Trent had leaned in, his voice low and steady. "Lots of these people are power brokers, Alicia," he said. "They'll be watching you as much as me. Stay confident, but keep your guard up. You never know who's playing nice just to get an edge. So best to vet every word that comes out of your mouth." He's preaching to the converted, but he's right. It's not just Janice.
Every smile directed toward me feels layered. Every handshake weighted with unspoken questions. But I keep my smile easy and my talk shallow and polite. Trent and I drift apart as he gravitates toward a group of guests and I head over to a high-profile photographer I recognize from Instagram.
Here she is, the belle of the ball.
Eleanor looms suddenly in front of me, taking a large swig of her drink. I can see by her flushed cheeks and slightly too loud manner, she's already had more than her fair share of the free champagne on offer.
My gorgeous wife tells me you're a natural party planner.
I look around, but I can't see Hazel anywhere, though I do notice Trent glancing over, checking out who I'm chatting to. Eleanor leans in closer.
Let's take a walk over to the bar area.
I follow her out of the thick hum of the crowd to the quiet end of the small bar tucked at one end of the room.
I'm only telling you this because I know you've been asking questions about her,
Eleanor murmurs, her voice low, still barely audible over the hum of the party. I raise an eyebrow, looking around quickly to make sure nobody is listening into our conversation. Questions about who?
Saskia. Who else?
Eleanor gives a wry smile.
Everyone seems to believe it was an accident, but see, I'm not so sure.
My heart skips a beat. What do you mean?
Hazel says I should keep my mouth shut, but... Eleanor's lips curl into a faint, enigmatic smile as she takes another sip of champagne. I'd seen Trent and Saskia arguing before it happened, a proper shouting match. She was never one to back down, and one time, about a week before she died, she said to me, I worry, he'll throttle me one of these days.
She shakes her head.
Trent can be controlling when he wants to be. When I heard what happened, I wondered if she'd pushed him too far and, well, you get my drift.
A chill seeps into my bones. Did you tell the police what she said after her death? I mean, I say, alarmed at her candor. Eleanor shakes her head.
Saskia could be a bit of a drama queen, and I had no proof. Plus, he's one of Hazel's best clients, so she'd have throttled me in turn.
I swallow, studying Eleanor's face as she knocks back yet more booze. Her eyes look slightly glazed. But she's not off her face or anything. Not yet. Still, she doesn't look concerned that she's spoken out of turn. Me being Trent's new girlfriend and all. Across the room, Trent raises an eyebrow, a faint smile tugging at the corner of his mouth. I can tell he's curious about what my conversation with Eleanor might be about, and I feel a pang of regret. Could it be true that Eleanor is unreliable, and he's a decent guy after all with nothing to hide? For now, I can't take what she says seriously. I'll ask her about it tomorrow when she's sobered up. Eleanor's attention has already been pulled elsewhere, and so the room floods back into focus as I look around. The crowd has thickened, the hum of conversation gearing up a notch. I feel a slight buzz from the champagne, and for a moment, I allow myself to believe that this poised, composed version of me is real. I scan the room, taking in the laughter, the chinking of glasses, the sharp tang of perfume and expensive cologne. And then I see him. The tall, broad man standing near the entrance. His face is partially obscured by the shadows cast by a low chandelier, and I get a strong compulsion to step back and to try to blend into the crowd. Steve Betts is watching intently. Not the room, not the guests around him. He's staring directly at me. Chapter 21. The back of my neck prickles. So, here he is at last, hiding in plain sight. Right in front of me, the major player threatening to scupper Trent's big Manchester investment. The person Trent thinks he's employing me to take a special interest in. I take in Betts's confident stance, the arrogant tilt of his head, the way his eyes seem to cut through the crowd straight to me. He's dressed like the other guests, in a tailored tuxedo and polished shoes. But there's an intensity about him. He looks like a man who is used to getting exactly what he wants. I glance around, looking for Trent for support, but he's engaged in conversation with a small group, his back to me, currently unaware of his VIP guest's arrival. Before I can move toward Trent, Betts steps forward, his gaze never wavering from mine. I paste a faint smile on my face, but underneath, I'm panicking. Trent has made it very clear he expects me to chat to him, so I can hardly just say hello and move swiftly on. When he reaches me, he leans in slightly, his voice low and slightly menacing as he holds my wrist in a pincer-like grip.
"So we speak at last, Alicia,"
he murmurs, a trace of something sharp in his tone. He looks over my shoulder to nod an acknowledgement to someone, before hissing,
"You're a hard woman to track down. What the hell are you playing at?"
My blood runs hot, then turns to ice. "I'm doing my job."
"Are you there?"
he says, with a menacing edge.
"Ignoring my messages, my calls? Why would that be?"
I'm aware of people creeping closer, hoping to get a word with him. "We can't talk about this here," I say, forcing a smile so smooth it feels foreign on my face. My nails press into my palms, a useful sharp bite of pain to keep me steady. The room hums around me, laughter, the clink of crystal glasses, the low murmur of polite conversation. A waiter drifts past with a tray of champagne and I reach for a glass. Anything to make this look like just another effortless exchange. Inside, my pulse hammers. I can feel the weight of his gaze, the unspoken threat curling between us like a wisp of smoke. I lift the glass to my lips, careful and controlled. "Not here," I repeat, my voice lighter now, almost amused, as if this is nothing more than a trivial inconvenience. But he'll know better. He can scent weakness in an instant.
"I think we both know you're not focusing on the job in hand,"
he says, a small smile playing at the corner of his mouth.
"You may have changed your outfit, your hair, your address, but you're still the same conniving little bitch inside, aren't you?"
He sneers, and I have to battle with myself not to visibly tremble.
"You've done well to get close so soon, but you need to focus on the mark. Specifically, find his weak spot."
His voice is smooth, but there's an edge to it, sharp as glass.
"The deal deadline is imminent. So, any ideas yet where it is I need to hit him hard?"
I keep my expression neutral, even as my stomach twists. The room is warm, the low glow of chandeliers casting everything in a soft golden light, but inside, I'm shivering. I take a slow sip of champagne, using the moment to steady myself. "These things take time," I murmur. "You can't rush something like this."
"That's not what you said before."
He steps in slightly, just enough to make it clear that this isn't a casual conversation.
"You're getting comfortable, aren't you? Cozying up too closely to Connors. I hope you're not forgetting where your loyalties lie and which one of us has the power to decimate your life as easily as that."
He snaps his fingers in front of my face. I force a small, amused laugh as if he's being ridiculous, as if my pulse isn't slamming against my ribs. "No need to be like that, Steve. I know what I promised."
"Then deliver it."
His voice drops lower.
"Or I will show you what I can do to you."
The party swirls around us. Music, chatter, the scent of expensive perfume. I nod as though we're just exchanging pleasantries, but I can feel my resolve shriveling. I have to find a way out of this, and fast. I take a step back, my gaze again flicking to Trent, praying now he doesn't turn around. But Betts moves with me, keeping the distance between us uncomfortably close. He's a wall I can't slip past.
"Excuse me, I need to speak to someone."
I force out the words. He gives a slow smile that makes my stomach twist.
"Rest assured, we'll be seeing more of each other soon, and I'm going to want something concrete from you. Know that I'm keeping a very close eye on you and your lovely little family."
The room tilts, my breath locking in my throat. Brody. I haven't heard from Jen yet. No update. No confirmation that he's okay. My phone is buried in my clutch and suddenly the weight of it feels unbearable, like it holds a life or death verdict I haven't dared check. I force myself to stand still, to hold his gaze as if his words haven't just wrapped cold fingers around my heart.
You don't have to remind me what's at stake, I hiss. You've done enough of that.
He leans in slightly, just enough to make my skin crawl.
It's not a threat. It's a reminder. You deliver, then we're good. Everyone stays comfortable.
The music swells. A burst of laughter ripples nearby, but it all feels distant, blurred. I nod like I've accepted his terms and move to walk away as if I'm still in control. Betts grasps my hand before I can fully clear him and presses a business card into it.
New number. Call me in the morning and maybe, if you've got anything interesting for me, I might not have to hurt anyone. Just maybe.
He walks away before I can respond, back the way he came, leaving me standing there, my pulse hammering, my palms damp. What an idiot I've been, risking my family, thinking I'm smart enough to play each man for what I can get. I look around, but he's already gone, vanished, as if I'd imagined his presence. I tuck the business card into my clutch purse, glancing around to make sure nobody has noticed. Betts periodically changes all his contact details, including his phone number.
I like to choose who I keep in contact with,
he told me once when I asked why. But it makes me wonder if he's running from some very dodgy people. The room settles again around me, the laughter and the music seeming louder. But I can't shake the realization I'm caught between the devil and the deep blue sea. My gaze locks onto Trent, who finally catches my eye, a small concerned frown creasing his brow. I force a smile, but I know he can see it in my face. Something's wrong. I thread through guests until I reach him, my hands trembling despite my best efforts to steady them. Trent's arm slips around my waist, his voice warm but cautious.
Everything all right with Steve Betts? I saw you collar him right away.
He grins and scans the room, a frown gradually replacing his smile.
Where is he now?
Over there, I say, finally catching sight of him again. He said he had some people here he wanted to see. I feel a chill run through me. Betts's words echoing in my head.
I'll keep a very close eye on you and your lovely little family.
To Betts about?
Sorry? I look at him, disorientated. Trent has been speaking and I've barely taken in a word he said.
What did you say? I said, what did you talk to Betts about? It's a shame he's already moved on to other company. He had a good chance there to get him talking. You're supposed to be working on getting closer to him.
Oh, yes, don't worry, I'll get the dirt.
I hope so. How much champagne have you had?
His eyes narrow.
You look a bit pale.
No, it was just small talk and then he got called away.
Did he upset you? He can be a dickhead at times.
No, I think you're right. I've overdone the champagne a bit. I'll go and get a glass of water. The weight of the lie presses down on my chest and I scurry off to the bar. I'm trying to put a brave face on when really all I want to do is run. I've done it again. Dug myself into a hole. But this time it's a hole so deep I don't know if I'll be able to scramble out. Suddenly, I feel my phone buzzing in my small bag. I pull it out quickly and read the text message from Jen. Doctor ruled out meningitis. He's on antibiotics now. Been a long day. Heading home. Speak tomorrow.
Thank you, God.
I mutter under my breath.
Thank you.
The relief I feel brings with it a sudden swell of opportunity. I can see Trent with a group of people, so this is a great time to carve out 10 minutes to myself to calm down again. I slip out of the party suite and head for the lift, Betts's threats still echoing my ears. In the penthouse, everything is still. I move quickly, my heels soundless on the thick carpet. Trent's office door is locked. Of course it is. I scan the nearby console table, the shelves, the sleek marble counter in the kitchen. No keys. Damn. I might have known he wouldn't leave them behind for the evening. I don't have any time to waste, so I slip into his bedroom instead, crossing the space in seconds. The air is still thick with his cologne, the subtle, expensive kind that clings to fabric. The room itself is impeccably tidy. Crisp linen, dark wood, curated luxury. But beneath the polish, it feels impersonal. I pull open the nearest drawer, neatly folded shirts. The next, watches, cufflinks, a scattering of receipts. I dig through, flipping a stack of papers in a leather folder. Business deals, contracts, things I barely have time to skim. Nothing that helps me. I stand still at a sound from the hall. Footsteps on the stairs. I shove the drawer shut just as Trent appears in the doorway. For a second, neither of us speaks. His gaze flicks to the closed drawer, then back to me. A small, knowing smile tugs at the corner of his mouth. Looking for something? My mind races. I press a hand to my forehead, willing my expression into something fragile. Headache, I murmur. I was looking for painkillers. His eyes don't leave mine. Then, with a slow exhale, he steps forward, reaching for my wrist. His grip is light, but there's no mistaking it for anything other than control. Let's get you back to the party. I don't argue as he guides me back to the Jupiter suite, his hand a firm presence at my lower back. To anyone watching, it looks like concern. Protective, even. But as we step into the golden glow of Party Central, he leans down, just enough so only I can hear him. Stay close, Alicia. I don't want you wandering off again. A shiver runs through me. I force a smile, but the feeling lingers. The orbit is exquisite, the penthouse dazzling. But the truth is, I've no more say in where I go here than a prisoner. Chapter 22. Sunday. My skull is still pounding when the morning light breaches the blinds, a physical reminder of the shock of how last night's summer party that I'd been so looking forward to had turned into a nightmare. I slip out of bed carefully and out into the hallway. I can hear Trent's steady breathing punctuating his dim, silent room. I don't want to disturb him, not least because he was visibly annoyed last night when I complained about a migraine and left early. But I know he'll have questions if I vanish without a word, so I scrawl a note. My son is very ill. He needs me today. Back later. Yes, I'm being vague, probably too vague, but that's all my brain can manage right now. After Betts left last night, I drank more than I should have done, just to get through to the end of the party. I called and texted Jen to warn her to be careful, to keep the door locked. It won't make any sense to her, but with Betts' threat ringing in my ears, I had to say it. There was no reply, so I guess she'd just crashed out when she got back from the hospital. But I knew what I had to do as soon as I woke up this morning. My heart clenches hard. Today, I'll see my son. The train station is quiet this early on a Sunday morning. I sink into my seat on the 10 o'clock to Nottingham, pressing my head against the cold glass. I text Jen again. On the train. Can't wait to see you both. A red heart pings back by way of reply, so that's something. I'd half expected her to try and put me off as usual. My mind drifts in and out, lulled by the rhythmic, soft clunk of the train as the landscape blurs past. I lurch between troubled dreams of Steve Betts's leering face pressing close and waking up with a start, wondering, momentarily, where I am. I glance at my phone to see a missed call and message notification from Trent. Hey, everything okay? I don't want to get into something with him, so I don't fully open the message. He'll see its status is still unread. At Nottingham Station, the midday sun is muted, hidden behind heavy grey clouds. I wave down a cab, asking the driver to drop me on the street next to Jen's. She lives in a modest red brick terrace on the edge of town, where the streets are narrow and lined with parked, mainly older cars. The small front garden is fenced in with weathered wooden slats, a handful of potted plants brightening the space. A narrow path leads from the pavement to the front door, its paint slightly chipped from years of weather and wear. It's a quiet enough area, mostly families, the occasional barking dog, and it's better than the rough area she used to live in. But even here, at night, muffled arguments sometimes drift from open windows, and teenagers on bikes hang out a little too long on the street corner. When Jen finally kicked that useless thug of a boyfriend of hers to the curb, I helped her scrape together the rental deposit so she could move away. The blinds are only half open, but I can see a telltale flash of light from the television. The front door opens just as I raise my hand to knock. Jen stands there, her eyes red-rimmed, her shoulders hunched in a way I haven't seen for a long time. She forces a smile and hugs me, but I can see she's washed out, exhausted. "I'm glad you're here," she says quietly, taking my coat. "Where is he?" I say, stepping past, my heart pounding as I catch sight of the small shape curled up on the couch in brushed cotton dinosaur pajamas. Brody looks up, his face pale, cheeks sunken and tired. His eyes meet mine, and he reaches out a tiny hand. "Mummy," he murmurs, his voice so faint, it's barely there, but it slices right through my heart like a knife. I kneel beside him, taking his little hand in mine, feeling the warmth of his skin, the slight clamminess. "Hey, sweetheart," I whisper, stroking his damp hair back from his forehead. There's a small red mark there. "What's this mark on his head, Jen?" She glances over and frowns. "Oh, he took a tumble, didn't you, little man?" Brody looks at her with wide eyes, his fingers tightening around my own. "Just a scrape, nothing to worry about." I look around the room. Clothes spill from an overstuffed laundry basket, a tangle of baby vests, crumpled t-shirts, and mismatched socks trailing across the floor. A half-dry flannel hangs over the arm of the sofa. The air is thick with the scent of coffee, stale food, and something slightly sour. Far be it from me to criticize Jen's living conditions, but the place is desperate for a good clean. Jen moves around us, shuffling into the kitchen and returning with a mug of tea for me. "Believe it or not, he's much better than last night," she says, eyes fixed on Brody. "They said he should be back to himself within a few days." My breath comes out in a long, shaky sigh. I say a silent prayer, my throat tight with all the things I can't express that are safer swallowed down. Brody's tiny hand is still in mine, his fingers tracing my knuckles with sleepy concentration, as if he's making sure I'm really here. "You look tired." Jen's voice breaks through my daze, and I look up to see her watching me closely. "So do you," I say, thinking what her reaction might be if she knew my exhaustion comes from having two men pulling my strings. That it's what I don't know that keeps me awake at night. The missing pieces. The danger I can sense but can't yet see. "Why don't I clean up a bit in here? If that would help." Jen stands near the edge of the room, half in the shadows, her arms crossed tightly over her stomach. She looks different. Too pale, too drawn, as if the weight of something unseen is pressing down on her, too. She keeps glancing toward the door, her fingers flexing at her sides like she's resisting the urge to bolt. I don't think she's even heard what I said. Something is wrong. I move toward her. "Jen, you seem... Are you okay?" My stomach knots. Whatever she's hiding, whatever has her looking like she's barely holding it together, why won't she trust me with it?
I'll be okay now Brodeur is on the mend, but...
She regards me with narrowed eyes.
You don't seem yourself lately. Is everything all right?
I force a shrug. The penthouse and the designer clothes lurk on the edge of my consciousness, all mixed in with the ghoul from my past who controls me and simply won't go away. It's just been a busy week. Jen raises an eyebrow, but I'm grateful when she doesn't press me for more details. I rummage through my bag and pull out the chunky bundle of cash I've brought with me, pressing it into her hands. This should keep you ticking along for a bit, I say. There's £1,000 there. Jen stares at it, blinking.
What the? Alicia, where's all this from?
I offer a weak smile. I asked for an advance. If she knew how much in total Trent had advanced me, and the mess I've got myself into, the questions would never stop. She purses her lips.
£1,000 is so much money. I mean, I know you'd said you'd got a good job, but...
I press her hand lightly and she stops speaking.
Just take it, Jen.
I say softly.
Please.
I've earned it, and I want you to have it. End of. She blinks.
When you texted last night, you told me to keep the door locked and keep safe. Keep safe from what?
I stare at her, my mind blanking out for a moment.
Someone came to the house yesterday, looking for you.
What? Who was it? Her fingers pull at the edge of her jumper.
I don't know, a man, he came by yesterday lunchtime. Tall, well-built, dark hair, I didn't get a name. But he said he'd worked with you and wanted to discuss some business. Said you weren't answering his calls so he had no option but to look for you.
Steve Betts is tall, well-built, with dark hair. But I can't imagine him doing his own dirty work. He has plenty of low-life thugs around him, though. He'll do that sort of thing for a few quid.
What did you tell him?
I say, trying hard not to alert Jen that I feel sick with worry.
I said you weren't here. I said you were working away at various places around the country because I didn't want to tell him you were in London either. But...
Yes.
He... asked if your son was here.
My breath catches.
He what?
Brodeur was asleep at the time, so I told him you'd taken him with you, that neither of you lived here.
Good.
That was good thinking, Jen. A wave of relief washes over me, quickly followed by a fresh spike of fear. Did he ask anything else? Did he say why he was looking for me or give any clue who he was? Jen shakes her head, but there's a flicker in her eyes, something she's not saying.
No, nothing else.
But he lingered.
Alicia, are we in danger?
The air in my lungs feels stagnant. 1,000 scenarios flood my mind, each one worse than the last. It sounds like Steve Betts knew exactly where to look for me, and he was looking for my son too. Here, where I thought he'd be safe after our move.
You've never told me exactly why you had to get away so quickly, Alicia.
I think I've got a right to know. If the man calling here has got anything to do with that, with your reasons for leaving, then you owe me the truth.
I'm struck dumb for a moment.
Jen is suspicious now, and my sister is not the sort of person who will easily let something like this go. I stand a bit straighter, realign my face.
It isn't anything to do with that, so don't worry.
There'll be a perfectly good explanation, I say, keeping my voice steady. As you've said, I'm doing well in London. I'll be coming for Brodeur as soon as I've got a place.
Jen doesn't look convinced.
And before that? The real reason you scurried off so fast?
A cold chill snakes down my spine, but I won't let her see it.
Look around you, Jen. I left so we wouldn't have to live like this anymore, so we could have a fresh start. That money I just gave you, that's proof it's working, right?
She folds her arms, jaw tightening.
Couldn't you have just...
No, Jen, I couldn't! The words snap out before I can stop them, sharp enough to cut through the air between us.
You think this is easy? That I just waltzed into a perfect life? I'm doing everything I can to fix this, to make things better for all of us, but I need time. And I need you to trust me.
Jen flinches slightly. But she doesn't back down. Her gaze searches mine, looking for something. Answers, reassurance. The truth. I can't give it to her, not yet. She exhales, shaking her head, but finally, mercifully, she lets it drop. I turn away, trying to steady my breath. I need to pull this off, and I can't afford anyone, not even Jen, to get in my way. My phone buzzes, another message banner from Trent.
What time are you back?
I push the phone back into my jeans pocket. When I look up, Jen is still watching me with a laser focus. I'm seized by a sudden urge to tell her everything. How there's far more at stake than she can imagine. How this life I've pieced together is already starting to crack. But I can't say any of it. If things fall apart here, my whole fictitious world in London crumbles, and then I've got nothing. Nothing but a lifetime working for Betts just to stop him hurting me and my family. But shadows are swimming in my sister's eyes. It doesn't matter how much crap you feed me, Alicia. I know something's off with you. You're not being straight with me.
Just cut me a bit of slack, Jen.
I'm begging you.
I admit there's stuff I can't talk about with you just now, but I will, I promise. Please don't worry, though. Everything is fine, my end.
She folds her arms.
So, if that guy comes back, I can tell him the truth about where you are.
No, I sigh. It's a misunderstanding. He won't come back. As I say it, I know I need to make sure that's the case. And the only way I can do that is to give Betts what he wants. Dirt on Trent.
Brody's eyelids flutter, his breaths evening out a little as he drifts into a restless sleep, lying beside me. He looks so fragile, as if he's made of glass. His skin is translucent in places, dark blue tiny veins patterning his pale flesh. I glance again at the angry red mark right on his left temple.
Is everything all right with you, Jen? I say lightly. Apart from Brody, I mean. How are you?
I'm okay.
She's distracted, her eyes flicking constantly around the room as if she's nervous something might be out of place. It's chaos in here, but there's something